Life as a paramedic in Austin, Texas is tough, but it's a rewarding job. The long hours and high-pressure calls can take a toll, but there's a satisfaction that comes with helping people on what might be the worst day of their lives. I thrive on that sense of purpose. It's not always dramatic rescues. Sometimes it's just a scared kid who fell off their bike or an elderly person who needs a lift back into their chair. Every call is different, which is what I've always loved about it. But this one call changed how I see my work forever. I'd met Natalie 2 years before at a barbecue hosted by a mutual friend. She was vibrant, outgoing, and had a way of making everyone around her feel like they were the most interesting person in the room. We clicked instantly. She loved hearing about my job, saying it was amazing how I could stay calm under pressure. For a while, things were great, but over time, cracks started to show. Natalie's energy turned into a need for constant attention. She hated the unpredictable hours of my job and resented how often I was on call. She'd get upset if I missed dinner plans or was too exhausted to go out. The disagreements became a regular thing, and it was clear we wanted different things. The breakup wasn't pretty. She accused me of prioritizing strangers over her, of caring more about my job than our relationship. She wasn't entirely wrong, but her intensity made it impossible to have a calm conversation. When I finally told her it was over, she stormed out of my apartment, slamming the door behind her. I thought that was the end of it. But I couldn't have been more wrong. It was one of those blazing hot June days, and my partner Tim and I were midway through a double shift. The calls had been steady all day. Heat stroke cases, a minor car accident, the usual summer chaos in Austin. Just after 4 p.m., we got a dispatch for a woman in her 30s experiencing chest pains at an apartment complex. It didn't seem urgent, but chest pain is one of those things you don't mess around with. We arrived at the scene within minutes, parking in front of a modest brick building. As I grabbed the medical bag, Tim looked at the notes on his tablet. Patient's name is Natalie, 32 years old. The name didn't register at first. Natalie is a common name, after all. But as we approached the door and I heard her voice calling out, "Come in!" I stopped in my tracks. "Wait," I said, turning to Tim. "I think I know her." Tim raised an eyebrow. "You sure?" Pushing open the door, I found Natalie sitting on the couch, clutching her chest and breathing heavily. She looked up at me with wide, tear-filled eyes. "Clay," she gasped. "Thank God you're here." My feelings were a jumbled mess, confused, annoyed, and oddly apprehensive. "Natalie, what's going on?" I asked, trying to keep it professional. "It started this morning," she said, her voice quivering. "This pressure in my chest, I thought it would go away, but it just keeps getting worse." Tim stepped in, asking her a series of routine questions while I checked her vitals. Everything looked normal: heart rate, blood pressure, oxygen levels. There was no sign of a medical emergency. "We should transport you to the hospital for further evaluation," Tim said. That's when Natalie's attitude changed. "No," she said firmly, sitting up straighter. "I don't need to go to the hospital. I needed to see Clay." Tim froze, looking between us. I'll give you 2 a minute, he muttered, stepping outside. I stayed where I was, gripping the medical bag. "Natalie, you called 911, I said, keeping my voice as calm as possible. "This is an emergency line. You can't use it to..." "To what?" she interrupted. "To talk to you? To get your attention? You've been ignoring me, Clay. I didn't know what else to do." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. "Natalie, do you have any idea how dangerous this is? You're tying up resources that could be used for someone who's actually in trouble." She leaned forward. "You don't get it. I've been miserable since you left. You just walked away like I didn't mean anything to you. How could you do that?" I shook my head, trying to focus. "Natalie, how did you even know I'd be the one to show up? There's no way to guarantee..." "I didn't," she admitted, cutting me off. "But I knew it was possible. I know your shifts, Clay. I know when you're working. I figured if I said it was serious enough, they'd send someone quickly, and maybe it'd be you." Her words hit me like a punch. She had used the 911 system as a gamble, risking lives just for a chance to force a conversation. The recklessness of it left me momentarily speechless. Natalie, do you hear yourself? You're gambling with people's lives, real emergencies. Just because you want to talk to me, that's not okay. That's dangerous. You left me with nothing, Clay. I didn't have a choice, she said. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Her obsession had pushed her to a point where consequences didn't matter anymore, and I realized just how far she was willing to go. I felt trapped. Here I was, in my professional capacity, trying to handle a situation that had nothing to do with medicine and everything to do with Natalie's obsession. The conversation escalated quickly. Natalie's tears turned into anger as she accused me of abandoning her, of never truly loving her. I tried to keep calm, reminding her that this was not the time or place for this discussion. You can't just walk away, she said, her voice rising. I deserve answers. I deserve closure. You need to talk to someone, Natalie. A therapist, maybe, but not me. Her expression changed, and for a moment I thought she might lash out physically. Instead, she leaned back against the couch, her tears returning. You'll regret this, she whispered. When I got back to the ambulance, Tim was waiting with a look of pure discomfort. So, that was something, he said. Yeah, I muttered, slamming the door shut. Back at the station, I reported the incident to my supervisor. They flagged the call in the system and advised me to file a personal report in case she tried to contact me again. Weeks later, I still couldn't rid myself of the apprehension. Mutual friends told me she had been asking about me, showing up at places she knew I might be. One friend even mentioned she'd started posting indirect messages on social media, clearly aimed at me. The whole experience was a wake-up call. Natalie's actions weren't just manipulative, they were dangerous. She abused an emergency service to...
Are you ready for more independence as a financial advisor? Consider the RIA model. Schwab Advisor Services has helped thousands of advisors make the move. To find your path, start with Schwab at advisorservices.schwab.com/paths today.
Force a confrontation, putting other lives at risk in the process. As paramedics, we're trained to handle medical crises, but no one prepares you for the emotional toll of something like this. It made me realize how vulnerable we can be both on and off the job. To anyone in my field or any profession where personal boundaries can blur, take situations like this seriously. Protect yourself, set boundaries, and never underestimate how far someone might go to regain control. After a rough breakup, the idea of starting over with someone new felt daunting. But after almost 1 year, I was finally ready to move on. Her name was Jenna, and we hit it off instantly. She was warm, easygoing, and had this infectious laugh that made everything feel lighter. For the first time in months, I was excited about the future. As a fitness trainer, trying to make the most of it, I work long hours almost every day, so having someone who brought calm and balance to my life was refreshing. We spent our first few weeks together, going on hikes, trying out new restaurants, and just enjoying each other's company. Things were going well, until the message came. It was a Tuesday evening, and I had just wrapped up a session with a client. My phone buzzed, and I looked at the screen. It was a text from my ex, Megan. Be careful. Two words, that's all it said. I stared at the message, not knowing whether to feel confused or annoyed. Megan and I had ended things a year ago, and while it wasn't the cleanest breakup, we'd managed to part ways without any major drama. At least that's what I thought. I hadn't heard from her since, and the suddenness of the message threw me off. I showed it to Jenna that night, and she just shrugged like it wasn't a big deal. Probably just her being petty, she said. Don't let it bother you. I agreed. Megan had always been a little dramatic, so I figured this was her way of trying to get under my skin. I blocked her number and didn't give it another thought. But now, I wish I'd paid more attention. A week later, I walked out to my car after a late shift at the gym to find two of my tires slashed. At first, I thought it was random vandalism, maybe some teenagers messing around. But then, 3 days later, I found the same thing had happened again, this time in the parking lot outside Jenna's apartment. "Do you think it's Megan?" Jenna asked. I wanted to say no, but the coincidences were piling up. I shook my head, trying to dismiss the thought. "I don't know. I mean, she'd have to know where we are. That's a lot of effort just to mess with me." But the discomfort was only getting stronger. I started paying more attention to my surroundings, always looking back when heading to my car and securing the doors at night. Jenna teased me for overreacting, but something about the situation didn't feel right. Things took a darker turn when my phone started acting strange. It began with little glitches, apps crashing, random restarts, but then I noticed something far more unsettling. Messages between Jenna and me had been deleted, and new ones appeared that I hadn't sent. One of the fake messages was chilling. "You're not safe with me." I immediately showed it to Jenna, who looked just as freaked out as I felt. "Who's doing this?" she asked. "I don't know, but I'm gonna find out." I took my phone to a client who's pretty skilled with tech stuff, and he confirmed what I suspected. Someone had hacked into it. The access point traced back to Megan's email, which made my stomach churn. She had gone from sending cryptic texts to actively invading my life. The breaking point came 2 weeks later. Jenna and I were grabbing lunch at an outdoor cafe when I saw her, Megan, standing across the street. She was just staring, her arms crossed, a slight smirk on her face. I froze, unsure of what to do. "Is that her?" Jenna asked, following my gaze. "Yeah," I muttered. Before I could decide how to handle it, Megan started walking toward us. She didn't stop until she was right in front of our table. "So this is the new girlfriend," she said, her tone dripping with sarcasm. "Megan, leave," I said firmly, trying to stay calm. But she ignored me, turning her attention to Jenna. "You should know he's not who you think he is," she said, her voice rising. "He'll leave you just like he left me. You're wasting your time." "Megan, stop," I said, standing up. "This isn't the place for this." But she kept going, shouting accusations and insults until other patrons started staring. Jenna looked terrified, and it made my anger flare up instantly. "That's enough," I said, stepping between them. Megan's face transformed into a look that was nearly alien to me. "You think you can just walk away from me? After everything we've been through?" she spat. "You don't get to move on like this." The tension peaked when Megan grabbed Jenna's arm, trying to pull her away from the table. That was the final straw. I called the police, and within minutes, two officers arrived to de-escalate the scene. Megan tried to play the victim, claiming I had led her on and that she was just trying to talk. But the officers weren't buying it. After hearing our side of the story and reviewing the messages on my phone, they took her into custody for harassment. Watching her get handcuffed was a surreal moment. I couldn't decide whether to feel relieved or sad. It was a bit of both. This was someone I had cared about once, someone I thought I knew. Now, she was a stranger, a dangerous one. The weeks following the confrontation were tense. Jenna and I changed our routines, avoided places Megan might know, and I even bought a new cell phone and changed to a completely different number. While the restraining order helped, the emotional toll stayed with me. Every time my phone buzzed or I heard a knock at the door, I felt a sudden knot of anxiety in my chest. Jenna tried to stay strong, but I could see how much it had shaken her. "Do you think she'll come back?" she asked one night. "I don't know," I admitted, "but we're going to be ready if she does." Looking back, I wish I had taken Megan's first message more seriously. "Be careful" seemed cryptic at the time, but it was a warning. A glimpse into the lengths she was willing to go to maintain control. This experience taught me that ignoring red flags, even small ones, can have serious consequences. People don't always let go as easily as you hope, and when emotions turn into obsession, the results can be dangerous. To anyone who can relate to this, trust your instincts and never underestimate what someone is capable of when they can't let go. Your safety isn't worth the risk. Breaking up with Sean was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made. We had been together for 3 years, and for most of that time, he seemed perfect. He was thoughtful, charming, and always knew how to make me laugh. But over time, I started to see another side of him, possessive, controlling, and overly intense. The arguments became more frequent, and his tendency to hold on to grudges started to weigh on me. I knew I couldn't stay in the relationship any longer. At first, it felt like a mature breakup. Sean didn't yell or argue. Instead, he just said quietly, "I understand. I want you to be happy." I remember feeling relieved as I left his apartment that day, thinking I had avoided the drama that so often accompanies breakups. I didn't see it then, but now I know his calmness wasn't acceptance. It was a mask for something far more sinister. About 2 weeks after the breakup, I was at work, wrapping up a meeting, when the receptionist called to let me know I had a package waiting at the front desk. I wasn't expecting anything, but the idea of a surprise brightened my day. The box was small, wrapped neatly in brown paper with no return address. Inside, I found a framed photo of Sean and me from a vacation we took to Cape Cod the previous summer. Alongside it was a handwritten note, "For the good times." At first, I thought it was sweet, albeit a little odd. I assumed Sean was just feeling sentimental and trying to process our breakup. I didn't think much of it and placed the frame in a drawer, deciding not to respond. The next package arrived at my apartment a week later. This time, it was a long, rectangular box like the ones florists use for bouquets. I opened it, expecting to find flowers, but what I found made my stomach turn. The box contained a dozen dead roses, their petals blackened and crumbling. Beneath them was a note written in Sean's unmistakable handwriting. "This is what happens when love dies." I stood there, completely paralyzed, not knowing what to do. My first instinct was to call him, but something stopped me. His note didn't feel like an apology or an attempt to reconcile. It felt like a statement, one meant to unsettle me. And it worked. By this point, I was definitely a little on edge. Every knock at the door, every unexpected package made my heart skip. I began to avoid Sean's usual hangouts, worried I'd run into him. Then, another package arrived, this time left directly on my doorstep. It was a small box, unmarked and taped shut. Inside was a folded piece of paper, thicker than the others he'd sent. Unfolding it, I realized it was a list titled, "Things I Loved About You." At first look, the entries seemed sweet. Your laugh, the way you care about others, your determination at work. But as I read on, I noticed several entries had been violently crossed out. Some were replaced with angry annotations. Your laugh, too loud sometimes. The way you care about others, but not me. And your determination at work, more like obsession. My hands were shaking by the time I got to the final entry. How you belong to me. Unlike the others, this one wasn't crossed out. It was circled over and over again, as if to emphasize its importance. I started keeping my blinds shut, and I even asked my landlord to install a security camera above the entrance to my apartment. One night, I got home late from work and noticed a shadow near the parking lot. My nerves flared as I struggled with my keys to open the door as fast as I could. By the time I looked out the window, the shadow was gone, but the fear wasn't. I considered reporting it, but how would it sound? Complaining about a few creepy deliveries from my ex? It didn't feel like enough to warrant a report. Instead, I confided in a coworker who offered to walk me to my car after work and check in regularly. His support helped, but it didn't take away the growing sense of dread. The final package arrived a month after the breakup. It was left on my doorstep again, despite the security camera. When I checked the footage later, all I saw was a hooded figure approaching my door, the grainy video offering no clues about the person's identity. The box was heavier than the others, and when I opened it, my breath caught in my throat. Inside was an empty picture frame. The glass was spotless, the edges polished, but there was no photo. Tucked inside was a single piece of paper with a message that chilled me to my core. "Now you have nothing." I called the police that night. The officer who came to my apartment listened patiently as I explained everything. The packages, the notes, the shadow near my parking lot. He filed a report and advised me to get a restraining order. It's better to take action now before things escalate, he said. Getting the restraining order was a complicated process, but it gave me a small sense of control. Sean denied everything when the police questioned him, claiming I was overreacting. I was just trying to be thoughtful, he said. But his words didn't match his actions. I changed my locks, and for weeks I avoided going out alone, always feeling like he was just around the corner. I often think about the packages, wondering what Sean's true intentions were. Were they meant to scare me, manipulate me, or were they simply the actions of someone who couldn't let go? Whatever the reason, they served as proof of how quickly love can turn into something threatening. When something doesn't feel right, take it seriously. Because sometimes the people we think we know best are the ones we should fear the most. When my relationship with Ethan ended, I thought I could finally move on. We'd been together for 2 years, and while things were fine at first, our differences became too much. I wanted stability. He thrived on unpredictability. Our breakup in March was amicable, or at least that's what I believed. We talked, cried a little, and wished each other well. But looking back, I realize now how much I missed in those final moments. Life after the breakup wasn't easy, but as a middle school teacher, I had plenty to keep me busy. By April, I was starting to feel normal again. I'd settled into a routine of grading papers at coffee shops, going for evening bike rides, and catching up with friends. That sense of normalcy was shattered one afternoon when I noticed something odd. I was at a coffee shop, pulling my laptop out of my bag, when a small black square fell out onto the table. At first, I thought it was a USB drive or some gadget from one of my students, but the longer I looked at it, the more I realized I didn't recognize it. It was sleek and glossy, with no markings. It didn't seem like anything worth keeping, so I tossed it in the trash and moved on. A few days later, I spotted something similar. I was locking up my bike outside the grocery store when I noticed a small device clipped underneath the seat. It looked almost identical to the first one. Same black casing, same size. I had a sinking feeling, but I reasoned it away as a coincidence. Maybe it had been stuck there by accident. But as I rode home that day, I felt the creeping sense of unease growing, no matter how much I tried to ignore it. Two identical gadgets appearing out of nowhere? It didn't feel right at all. Weeks passed, and the strange occurrences no longer seemed to matter. That is, until my car started making a rattling noise. I took it to a mechanic, expecting to hear it was a loose bolt or something minor. Instead, he walked into the waiting area holding another one of those devices. "Found this under your bumper," he said, handing it to me. "It's a GPS tracker." I stared at him, my brain struggling to process his words. "A tracker?" I repeated. "Yeah, these are pretty common. People use them for fleet vehicles or other reasons." I felt like the floor had been pulled out from under me. Someone was tracking my car. I thanked him, stuffed the device into my pocket, and drove home. My mind wouldn't stop racing the entire way. Who would do this? Was it Ethan? The thought felt absurd. He'd always been calm, even during fights. But then again, who else could it be? By the time I got home, I was spiraling. I started tearing through my belongings, searching for anything that didn't belong. My purse, my gym bag, my jackets, everything was a potential hiding place. And then I found it. Another tracker sewn into the lining of my backpack. The stitching was sloppy, like someone had done it in a hurry. My heart pounded as I stared at the tiny device. This wasn't a coincidence. Someone was deliberately tracking me. I couldn't sleep. I kept checking the locks on my doors and windows, convinced that someone was outside watching. The idea that Ethan might be behind this started to feel less absurd. He knew my routines, my favorite places, even where I parked my car. I decided to confront him. I needed answers, and I couldn't live with this paranoia any longer. I called him and made sure to sound natural. "Hey, Ethan, can we talk? Something weird has been happening, and I just want to clear the air." He agreed to meet me at a park we used to go to. The sun was setting when I arrived. Ethan was already there, leaning against a bench with his hands in his pockets. I didn't waste time with pleasantries. "I've been finding tracking devices," I said. "In my bag, on my car, even in my backpack. Do you know anything about this?" His reaction was a mix of surprise and defensiveness. "What? No. Why would I do that?" I stared at him, searching his face for any sign of deception. "Ethan, I'm not stupid. Who else would do this?" His hesitation was clear, his eyes darting away. I wanted to make sure you were safe," he admitted finally. "You're out there alone now, and I didn't want anything to happen to you." I was consumed by anger and disbelief. "You think stalking me is keeping me safe? Do you even hear yourself?" He tried to justify it, saying he hadn't meant any harm, that he was just looking out for me. But his words only made me angrier. I told him to stay away from me, to never contact me again. The next day, I filed a police report and started the process of getting a restraining order. The officers were sympathetic but honest. "These cases can be tough to prove," one of them said. "Even with a restraining order, there's no guarantee he'll stop." I informed my closest neighbors about the restraining order against Ethan, asking them to call the police if they saw him near our building. I even started parking my car in different spots, trying to make myself harder to track. But no matter what I did, I still felt like he was watching me. Every time I left the house, I'd check my surroundings, looking for anything or anyone out of place. For the next week, I noticed a car parked on a street near my apartment that looked a lot like his. It wasn't parked there every day, and sometimes it would be gone by the time I got home, but when I did see it, my stomach twisted into knots. I'm not great with cars, so I couldn't say for sure if it was his, but the resemblance was enough to keep me on edge. Every time I spotted it, I'd hurry inside and make sure that my doors and windows were locked. As the weeks went by, I stopped seeing the car altogether. Maybe it was never his to begin with, or maybe he'd finally moved on. Either way, the paranoia seeped into every aspect of my life. I stopped going to the coffee shop, stopped biking to the grocery store. I even started taking different routes to work, hoping to throw off anyone who might be following me. Even after all this time, I'm still paranoid enough to check my bags and car for trackers. I've learned to take precautions, but the experience has left scars I can't ignore. The people we think we know best can sometimes be the ones we should fear the most. Trust that little voice in your head. Sometimes it's the only thing keeping you safe. If these chilling stories kept you on the edge of your seat, don't forget to hit that like button and share this video with your friends who love a good scare. Make sure to subscribe and turn on notifications so you never miss our next terrifying upload. Have your own story about a crazy ex? Drop it in the comments or email me. I'd love to feature it in a future video. Remember to stay safe and always trust your gut when something feels off. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next nightmare.